You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Back from your trip.
Yeah, the Chipping Camden 2 day, the inaugural Chipping Camden 2 day. It's going to be on the world tour in a couple of years.
Just about recovered, blisters have healed. And Daniel Freeb.
How are you?
I'm very well, Daniel. Daniel, you're out there in Mallorca. Are you actually clothed?
Yes, I am, Richard. Just island living, Richard, you know. I think you're referring to what you can see on Skype camera, but you know,
I can see a couple of bare shoulders. Very tantalizing.
This is how we roll. Anyway, I hear it's very hot over there. What's it like in Watford, Lionel?
I don't know. I don't live in Watford, Daniel. but where I live, it's really quite warm. Yeah.
And Lionel's here with me at the moment.
But I'm at Richard, in Richard's garden office. Very nice. First time I've seen the garden office, Rich.
Apart from when squirrels run across the roof.
Well, they won't interrupt with the recording,
no,
will they?
No, definitely not.
It's been a torrid summer for you, Lionel, hasn't it? What with the Giro, with the unseasonably, unusually hot weather at the Giro. We know how you suffer in the heat.
I love the hot weather, as long as I don't have to do anything. Yeah. It's going to be a hot tour, isn't it? It's going to be a very hot Tour de France.
Well, we're overwhelmingly in the south of France.
I'll survive.
Listen, this is our last podcast before the Tour de France, the aforementioned Tour de France. It's sped up upon us, always unnerving when we're kind of middle of June, but the tour is just around the corner because it begins this year on the 1st of July, which is quite unusual, which I think is your birthday, isn't it, Lionel?
It is. My birthday will be celebrated in Dusseldorf. We've already got a restaurant booked on the Saturday night in Dusseldorf, specialising in German cuisine, as you'd expect. Looking forward to that. That
great.
Will be after the opening time trial. But we go a week tomorrow.
Yep.
It's looming rapidly.
It's imminent. It's imminent, and we're just about ready. We'll tell you a bit later in the podcast some of our plans for the tour. Some of them, not all of them, because we haven't decided on all of them yet, but we'll tell you some of them. But before we do any of that, Lionel, the news roundup, please.
Yeah, rattle through a very busy week of racing. Simon Spilak won the Tour de Suisse for the second time in his career. He does seem to go very well in Switzerland, the Katusha rider, because he's won the Tour of Romandy once as well, and he's been runner-up three times at the Tour of Romandy. But Spilak has a bit of a phobia about the Grand Tours and won't be riding the Tour de France, but plenty of other riders have been in action who will be hoping to be on the start line in Dusseldorf. One of them that's hoping to be there is BMC's Rowan Dennis. He won the prologue time trial and the final time trial in the Tour de Suisse, but he's not currently guaranteed a place in the BMC team for the Tour de France. It's slightly surprising that. We'll maybe talk about that a little bit in the episode, because he won the opening stage of the Tour in Utrecht 2 years ago. The Tour this year starts with a very similar length time trial in Dusseldorf, around 13.8 kilometres, I think it is. And originally the Tour wasn't on his race programme, but after he crashed out of the Giro after only 3 or 4 days.
Zetna, wasn't it? Zetna stage, was it?
He tried to start, didn't he? Or he did start and then he pulled out. But he could be handy support for Richie Port. So we'll watch and see as the Tour teams get announced early next week whether he's in the BMC lineup. The other stage winners in Switzerland included Philippe Gilbert, Michael Matthews, Larry Warbass, friend of the podcast, Domenico Pozzovivo, fresh out of the Giro, and the world champion Peter Sagan, who won twice. And with Sagan going well, it's been a really great week for Bora Hansgrohe, because their climber, Rafael Majka, won a stage in the overall at the Tour of Slovenia. Not a huge race, but a morale-boosting win for the former Tour King of the Mountains there. And their sprinter, the Irishman Sam Bennett, won twice, including a victory over Mark Cavendish, who is returning to fitness after being diagnosed with Epstein-Barr virus. We might have a bit of info on whether Cavendish is going to make it to Dusseldorf a little later in the episode. Other riders who will expect to be there: Primoz Roglic, Dylan Groenewegen and Marcel Kittel won stages of the ZLM Tour in the Netherlands, and that was won overall by Katusha's Portuguese rider José Goncalves. Sylvain Dillier won the Route du Sud in the French Pyrenees. You may remember that he was the BMC rider who took that very close sprint finish over Jasper Stuyvesant at Terme Louisiana at the Giro d'Italia. He was on social media expressing his surprise and disappointment at not getting a ride at the Tour de Suisse, which is his home race, of course, and he made his point very firmly by winning the Route du Sud, an impressive stage race win for him. Pierre Rolland and Tom Scully won back-to-back stages for Cannondale Drapac there. So Roland is going to the Tour, I think, isn't he? And will be hunting stages there, as he did at the Giro. Little nod for the Australian rider, Brenton Jones, who recently won the Rafa Nocturne in London. He followed that up by winning the final stage of the Tour de Corea for JLT Condor. Off the bike and away from the racing, we'll probably not go into this right now, but as the election gets closer later in the year, we will discuss
another
this, no
election.
Doubt. Another election, yeah. Will the UCI be a hung parliament? The French Federation boss, David Lapartient, has announced that he will stand against the current president, Brian Cookson, and that election is later on in the year.
Exciting.
Not really, is it?
Well, I mean...
Important, but not necessarily exciting.
Important, sorry, yeah. But a lot of racing, as you say, Lionel, and Switzerland, I suppose, was the main one, although it's not the race it was in terms of the field, the Tour de Suisse. Very few GC riders or GC riders with ambitions for the Tour de France go there these days. Yoni Zagiri, it was perhaps the only one who will go to the Tour's leader, Rodo K. Expect more from him at the Tour, but a lot of good sprinters, obviously. Michael Matthews, John Degenkolb, Peter Sagan, Michael Matthews looked good. I mean, two teams actually that at the start of the year I think we talked about as being quite light in terms of their squad and worrying about how they would do, Bora Hansgrohe and Sunweb. And I think both those teams have been, they've been two of the teams of the season. I think Sunweb did a fantastic job to lead out Michael Matthews into Bern, beautiful Bern where we were for the Tour de France last year. Got a win there over John Degenkolb, which would have been satisfying. Degenkolb obviously used to ride for that team. But Sunweb, for the resources that they have, you know, they've got a couple of, you know, good leaders in Matthews and Dumoulin. Sunweb are doing extremely well, I think. And Bora Hansgrohe, you know, a team that we thought was all about Peter Sagan. You mentioned Rafał Majka, Sam Bennett. We saw Buchmann recently at the Dauphiné as well, Emmanuel Buchmann, the young rider. They're doing really well as a team, I think. And they've unveiled their nine-man squad for the Tour today. And look, it's very strong.
Yeah, I mean, you look at Bora Hansgrohe and with Peter Sagan and going for a record-equaling sixth green jersey this year. It would be six in a row, wouldn't it? Erik Zabel has that record. Sagan could equal that. You'd be surprised if he weren't to win a stage or two or three. And then Majka as well could win a stage or two.
And polka dot.
And the polka dot. So Bora could come out of the Tour with both the, I don't want to say minor jerseys, but the other jerseys. But they're not going to win the race overall. But, you know, they've got plenty of firepower there. And you're right, we kind of thought of them as the Peter Sagan vehicle, but they've got a lot more going for them. And that's Daniel's point. He always makes that winning breeds winning. You know, the fact that they've been on such a roll, they had a very good Giro with Perstelberger winning the opening stage and having the pink jersey for a day. They were very active in the race as well. And, you know, in between the Giro and the Tour, other riders have come to the fore. Sam Bennett getting a couple of wins, although he's not going to ride the Tour. That will be a huge boost for him, particularly as he beat Mark Cavendish in Slovenia. That was a bit of a monkey off his back for him.
I think, Rich, just on Sunweb and, well, and Bora as well, you talked about their rich vein of form recently, and certainly things have gone really well for Sunweb against the odds in some cases. You know, wins like Bauhaus's win at the Dauphiné were certainly unexpected, and Bora have had a few unexpected ones as well. You mentioned Perstelberger at the Giro. I think the problem for both of those teams is that their main riders, so Matthews for Sunweb and Sagan for Bora, certainly as far as stage wins are concerned, are not going to have that many opportunities at the Tour. I think it's a bit of a move away this year's Tour de France from the trend of stages where the sprinters really have to work hard to get to the finish, which, you know, we've seen a lot of in recent years, and we've seen the emergence of this breed of rider, the Matthews, the Sagan, the Degenkolb, the sort of the fast but versatile riders who can climb pretty well. I was talking to Ben Swift at the Dauphiné last week, and he's obviously in that vein, and he said, well, yeah, you know, my form is good and looking forward to the Tour de France, but looking at the route itself, there aren't that many obvious opportunities where there's a small climb in the finale. Certainly in the first week, it's difficult to see any of those, that kind of stage. So guys like Matthews and Sagan might have to work quite hard and might have to wait quite a long time for their first opportunity of a stage win. And I think, you know, Sagan's won the green jersey. How many times has he won it now? Is it four in a row now?
Five in a row, going for six.
Five in a row. So, you know, just taking the green jersey, which we all expect him to do, will probably be seen as a bit of an anti-climax from his point of view. And he will be looking for stage wins. But they might come quite late in the race this year.
Yeah, there is the uphill finish at Longwy on the first Monday. But that's not really the Michael Matthews territory, is it? I think it's a bit too hard, a bit too steep. It's not a sort of a sprint finish. It's more of a sort of mini Mur de Huy type finish, just from looking at the route profile. Obviously, when we get there and we see it, you know, this always happens. We'll probably reevaluate, or we'll evaluate it with our own eyes. But you're right. The flat stages do look much more bunch sprinty, don't they? Marcel Kittel type territory, Mark Cavendish type territory, if he's going to be there.
Well, we'll talk about Cavendish in the next part. Just finishing on Switzerland, as we were finishing recording last week, I glanced at my Eurosport player, and there was Larry Warbass off the front on his own. And as you mentioned, Lionel, friend of the podcast, Larry Warbass, he featured in one of our friend specials last year, the Young Americans with Ian Boswell and Joe Dombrowski. And as he was riding to a brilliant win for Aqua Blue, the Irish Pro Continental team that has got an invitation to some World Tour events, including the Vuelta later on in the year. You know, Larry's ridden for IAM Cycling, for BMC before that. One of the things he talked about when we met up in Nice last year was the frustration, I suppose, of knowing that he and Joe Dombrowski, and Ian as well, have the numbers to perform, to pull out wins like that. And the difficulty is in executing and in getting the opportunity, especially if you're on a World Tour team. So on a Pro Continental team, he's had the opportunity to go for the win. He's got it quite brilliantly, and it obviously meant a lot to him. A very revealing show of support from a lot of his fellow professionals, actually. If you didn't tweet your congratulations to Larry Warbass, you have to look at yourself in the mirror, professional cyclist. It was incredible. He's obviously a very popular guy, very friendly guy. He did a Ernest Hemingway impression for the podcast, of course, at the Tour of the Basque Country last year as well. But anyway, one comment that he made during our friend special really stuck in my mind, and I thought we'd play it again. You can become a friend of the podcast still for last year at thecyclingpodcast.com. It's £10 for access to all of our friend specials from last year. But let's hear from Larry Warbass talking about the frustration of having that big engine and not being able to show people, I guess, in races.
All three of us have very good numbers and big potential, and maybe we haven't exactly seen the translation of that to race results, you know? Or we definitely, in terms of potential, we haven't seen the race results that what these numbers show, you know? And so I guess what I was writing is, you know, it was, I guess one day I hope that we will all deliver on that potential. And I know that I could see that exact same thing happening to us, where we, oh, where did these guys come from, you know? Well, you know, cycling isn't just these numbers. I can't just go out, maybe I can go do 6 point something watts per kilo on a climb for 20 minutes if I go out tomorrow morning and just go straight from the gun. But the difference is, at the end of 6 hours, after you're fighting with these guys, you know, maybe it's 3 weeks into a race, 2 weeks into a race, and, you know, there are so many other little things that go into it, like, you know, saving energy in the peloton, or, you know, even eating and drinking, and, you know, these things where you don't think about, that you learn every year how to do better and better. And it's even, like we were speaking about earlier, the lifestyle off the bike, you know, all of that has to add up. There's 1,000 factors that go into being able to turn those numbers into a result on the paper at the end of the day, you know? And so I think he was taking way too simple of a view of it, and that upset me. So I was trying to, I guess, respond to that, because people who aren't in cycling, and even some people who are in cycling, they don't realize it's not as easy as it sounds or looks, you know? And so numbers are great, and it's good to have them. But unfortunately, for us sometimes, it's not everything. And, you know, but I think that's sort of the fun of the sport as well, is, you know, maybe you do have this potential, but succeeding in the sport is finding how to get your potential out onto the road and, you know, at the end of the race, into the race results.
Become a friend of the podcast to access 11 exclusive shows for just £10. To sign up, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport, who are sponsoring the Cycling Podcast throughout 2017. Very grateful to them. And a reminder that you can get 20% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com. Enter the code CPOD20 at the checkout. That's CPOD20 for 20% off. We'll be going to the Tour de France armed with some Science and Sport products for some of the bike rides we'll be doing there. Lionel, we're both taking bikes this year. Also, stay tuned for some Science and Sport competitions during the tour. And we've got one to announce this week. This is the Science and Sport Strava Challenge. Head over to Strava and sign up for the Science and Sport Cycling Strava Challenge for your chance to win a Cervelo S3 and £500 worth of Science and Sport product. The challenge that people have to complete is to ride for a total of 4 hours between the 26th of June and the 2nd of July. The link on Strava is strava.com/challenges/science-in-sport-cycling-competition. That's strava.com/challenges/science-in-sport-cycling-competition. Good luck with that.
A Science and Sport gel came to my rescue on the 2-day Chipping Camden Classic, I have to say.
Yeah.
Very hot, had no appetite for solid food, so I was relying on the gels a little bit on the second day.
Do the gels...
Hang on. You had no appetite for solid food.
I know.
Well, hang on.
Rich, is that Lionel there? Or have we been joined into an interloper?
And do the gels counterbalance the red wine quite effectively, Lionel?
Well, we actually had white wine
night
before. Yeah, we had a nice bottle of Puy Fumé, which was very nice.
A bottle?
Oh, it was very nice. Well, let's not count. But no, it's a terrific 2-day cycling trip that I had, a leisure trip.
You mean a bottle with each course?
Yeah, we only had 3 courses, so it was fine.
But yeah, I mean, it sounds like a great trip. That was you and Simon, the photographer.
Yeah, and a friend of his called Roland. It was great. Yeah, we sent our clothing ahead by Parcel Force. Other courier companies are...
What?
So we could just cycle, and then our clothing was waiting for us at our hotel.
You
and then
posted
we,
your clothing?
Yeah, and then posted it back, and it arrived back home like the next day. Yeah,
that's
so
amazing.
So you could just ride a bike without having to carry a rucksack or any kind of panniers or anything. You just do, yeah... 4 hours out, 4 hours back.
Never brilliant. Heard of that before.
After Team Sky and the motorhome, the aborted motorhome controversy of last year, now we have the Lionel of Flanders and Parcel Force.
Did you send it in a jiffy bag? Or
no, we didn't send it in a jiffy bag. Sent it in a box. But we were actually talking, Rafa should design like a bag for this very purpose. It's a space for your clothes, your wash bag, your trainers and stuff with a solid... window in it, so you can put the address of where you're sending it and then turn the address over and send it back to
Should
your home.
Should you be sort of sharing this to all our listeners and potentially other companies who might just get in there first? This should be a private conversation with Rafa.
Probably should. But
anyway, it's too late for that.
I'll take just 20%
we can't go back and edit that bit out, so it's too late. And before we heard Science Sport, we heard from Larry Warbass there. Always interesting, Larry. As I said earlier, you can retrospectively become a friend of the podcast for 2016. You can, of course, also become a friend of the podcast for 2017. I think we've released 6 episodes so far this year.
That's right.
And there are at least another 5 to come. We'll look out for some Tour de France extras as well. And yeah, we've got some good ones still to come up. Become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. There's one that should be coming up quite soon, but Daniel's told me not to mention it, so I'm not going to mention it. But very excited about that one. Daniel, you were going to give us a bit of an update on Mark Cavendish,
yes,
who you've been in regular contact with, I understand. He's, of course, been fighting illness.
Some of it unwanted, uninvited, but yes. Yeah, well, he made his comeback to racing last week, didn't he, at the Tour of Slovenia, when he wasn't prank calling journalists, and did pretty well, finished second in the final stage of the Tour of Slovenia, and didn't really answer questions about whether he's going to ride the Tour de France. The obvious conclusion to draw from his second place in that final stage in Slovenia is that Dimension Data will throw him into the Tour, even if it's only for a week. I'm sure if they do pick him for the Tour, they won't say that it's only going to be for a week. I'm sure they will say, and he will say, that he's going to try to complete the Tour de France. But given what we said about the very flat stages the glut of very flat stages in the first half of the Tour de France, you would think that he would be able to ride himself into some kind of form that will enable him to compete for even one stage victory to edge him closer to the record, Eddy Merckx's stage victory record in the Tour de France. How many short is he now? Is he four short or two short?
Four. He's on 30, isn't he? And Merckx on 34.
Yeah.
I mean, he's obviously returned to racing and he's going well, Daniel, and he's missed a lot of racing and missed a lot of training. So, you know, he might not have the base that he would like. But is he fully recovered? Does he feel that he's recovered from the illness?
I think that the recovery itself has been a real roller coaster. I mean, I spoke to him at the start of the week before the Giro d'Italia, and at that point, he wasn't really doing any serious training or any significant training. He was told that he had to keep his heart rate, I think, below 110 or 120 when he was going out on rides. And this was something that he really struggled with because Cavendish is the kind of rider who has always trained hard and not necessarily trained for a lot of hours, but trained very hard, pretty near kind of race intensity a lot of the time. So this was foreign to him to sort of observe this period of active rest. And at that point, you know, I asked him from a standing start, because at that point he had really no base, no form, and was also having to pay a lot of attention to his weight, because not riding, we know that he's someone who tends to put on weight quite easily. So it wasn't looking good. And I said, how long do you need from a standing start? And he said, well, 10 weeks, and there are only 8 weeks to the Tour de France. So there's almost zero chance that I'll be ready. You know, there were a couple of false starts as well, a couple of weekends, or there was one weekend in particular when I think he had some encouraging information, or I think Rolf Aldag, the Dimension Data team manager, maybe suggested that he just try out a harder session, see how it went. And he did that, and the feedback wasn't particularly good. I think he was very tired after that, and it looked as though he was back to square one again. But then, yeah, another week or so went past, and he started doing double sessions some days. He was doing 6-hour sessions, and he started to feel better. And I think over the last few weeks, he's put in a really intensive period of training. He's had teammates that have come to stay with him. Bernie Eisel's been with him in Tuscany, and they had a bit of a training camp, and everything by all accounts has been going pretty well. I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago, and he said, well, I might be able to compete in small races, but the Tour is still looking as though I probably won't be able to compete, but we're going to leave it until the last minute to make a decision, maybe even the week before. And and now we have these results in Slovenia to, as I say, suggest that maybe he might just have pulled off a bit of a miracle. And Dimension Data obviously desperately need him to be there, because they've had their other big hitter, Steve Cummings, out since the Tour of the Basque Country. He hasn't raced. He is going to be ready, I'm pretty confident, for the Tour de France. He's recovered from a broken collarbone, broken sternum. I mean, he's identified a couple of stages. I think the Station des Russes will be a first really good opportunity for Steve Cummings. But Dimension Data really need both of those guys, because otherwise, their roster, certainly as far as the Tour de France is concerned, looks quite thin. Edvald Boasenhagen had a good run of results in Norway at the Tour of Norway and the Tour of the Fjords in the spring, but he hasn't really competed that well in the sort of company we talked about at the start of the podcast today: Michael Matthews, Peter Sagan, those punchy, fast sprinters who can climb. So yeah, fingers crossed as far as Dimension Data are concerned.
Well, even if it's touch and go with Cavendish, you looking at not just their roster but also at Mark Cavendish's pedigree, if he's even sort of 75% fit at the start, you take a gamble, because, you know, wheel out the cliche for the first time of the year, the Tour is the Tour. Once it's up and running and underway, you can't answer the question. But if he's able to just ride himself in, you just never know. He's such a competitor as well. That's worth a few percent to him when it comes down to it. And as we've seen in the past, you know, when he's been in what we thought roaring form, you know, results haven't gone his way. That goes for all the sprinters. You know, when they get into the finishing straight, anything can happen. And, it's a bit like when a football team has a player who's, makes a big difference for them, but has been injured prior to a World Cup or a European Championships. You know, you take him, put him in the squad. I know he's got a...
Put him on for the last 20 minutes.
Yeah, put him on for the last 20 Ks. Well, it's going to be difficult, isn't it? They're not going to be able to do that. They're showing the whole race from start to finish.
None of that this year won't happen anymore.
Sorry,
I'm reading Peter Cousins' book about the first ever Tour de France in 1903, so I've got all kinds of crazy ideas in my head about what you might do to take shortcuts and so on. Sorry, Daniel.
Also, just looking at the competition that Cavendish is likely to face, I mean, I think we all thought when Marcel Kittel joined Quickstep Floors that he was really going to consolidate his domination in sprints and he was going to be very, very hard to beat over the next couple of years. I don't think he's necessarily done that. He won a stage at the ZLM Tour last week, but he hasn't, I don't think he's been a really intimidating presence or the intimidating presence that we thought he was going to be in sprints. Then Greipel, I noticed that he's pulled out of the German National Championships with a stomach bug, but at the Giro he won his stage, but he wasn't that impressive. We've got these young sprinters, Gaviria and Ewan, who aren't going to be riding the Tour, not yet ready. And then the Dauphiné, the three French sprinters, Coquart, Buhani and Demar, were unconvincing in various different ways. Demar was brilliant in winning one sprint, but then, you know, his team wasn't particularly good another day. And Coquart is at loggerheads with his team manager, not sure if he's even going to ride the Tour de France. Buhani's got a terrible record of self-sabotage in the Tour de France or before he even gets to the Tour de France. So the competition is not that intimidating, I would suggest.
I suppose for Dimension Data, on paper, on the face of it, you absolutely would. You would put Cavendish in if he's at 60, 70%. I suppose the difficulty comes in selecting the rest of the team. I'm curious to see whether, and I've no idea whether he's even in line for it, but Lachlan Morton, is he possibly in line for the Tour? Or are they saving him for the Vuelta? I'm not sure. But there are lots of interesting riders on that team, Steve Cummings being one, some of the African riders also, who are not going to be perhaps very useful to Mark Cavendish on a flat stage and a sprint stage. And there are riders like Renshaw, Izzo, I'm sure is one of the first names on the team sheet anyway. But there are other riders who would only go to help Cavendish. And so it does start to have implications for the rest of the team as well. So some difficult decisions, but they haven't named the team yet, but I would be very, very surprised if Cavendish isn't in it.
Whoever you are, whatever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Thank you very much indeed to our main sponsor, Rafa. Very grateful, as always, to them for their support. And a bit of Rafa news. We're launching Rafa, on our behalf, are launching our new range of clothing. That'll be next week, just before the Tour. Not entirely sure what day yet, but a couple of days before the Tour, that will be available. Initially, it will be a Pedaleur de Charme t-shirt, a very nice Pedaleur de Charme cycling jersey, and a hat as well, a casquette. That will all be available through our website and also, obviously, at rafa.cc. You know, let us know what you think of it. The range may be expanded in the future. We don't know. We'll see how this goes, but it looks very nice, very nice design. And we'll also be going to the Tour armed, of course, with Pedaleur de Charme t-shirts to award to riders.
And a travel iron, hopefully.
Yeah, we're going to invest in a travel iron, a Rafa travel iron, in order to not...
I owe you for a travel iron.
You do, actually, Daniel. That's why poor old Kasia Niviadoma had to accept a very unironed t-shirt recently at the Women's Tour. Sorry about that. But yeah, very nice they are. And we'll be presenting them, awarding them at the Tour in the same way as we did at the Giro, weekly, and with a listener poll to determine the winner. We'll be accepting nominations from day one, I suppose. Also connected to Rafa, in Dusseldorf, we are planning at the moment, and the slot is not quite finalised, but myself, Lionel Burney and Francois Tomazo are going to appear at the pop-up store, the Rafa pop-up store in Dusseldorf on the Friday evening, we think, but we haven't had the time confirmed yet. We will be confirming on Twitter and Facebook and anywhere else the exact time, but we're hoping to be there Friday evening, Dusseldorf. It's always difficult, Tour de France. The Tour is the Tour. Lots going on. But at some point on the Friday evening, we'll be appearing at the Dusseldorf pop-up and doing a little preview podcast for the Tour de France. It's the plan, isn't it, Lionel?
That's the plan.
That's the plan. What else should we should look ahead to the tour? I mean, want to mention the national championships first. I mean, we've got them always traditionally before the tour, the weekend before the tour. The British national championships are on the Isle of Man this year, a great home of racing and of cyclists, including, of course, Mark Cavendish. Very tough course. They're going two times up Snaefell Mountain. They're going around the TT circuit twice, 37.7 miles. And Snaefell Mountain is a proper climb, you know, really hard, hard climb. So doing two laps of that. The old Manx International used to be three laps. And the last time the national championships were held in the Isle of Man was 1995, and the winner was a certain Robert Miller.
And he took off very early, didn't he? He rode away from everybody.
Showed his class.
Won that. He was riding for a French team, Le Groupement, which was sponsored by basically a pyramid selling company, which went bust between the national championships and the start of the Tour de France in that week, basically. I think it may already have gone bust. I have to read up and check on the exact timeline. But it meant that Miller couldn't ride the Tour in 95, and nor could Luc Leblanc either, who was the world champion. So the French world champion, Luc Leblanc, was an absentee as well. But I remember that 95 world championship, national championships, because basically the time gaps were so big behind Miller, you know, the difference between someone who was used to riding, you know, real top level races. The spread of abilities in the field that day was probably quite big, bigger than perhaps it is now, because, you know, there'll be a very strong contingent of British riders over there. A few people in very good form. Peter Kenyuk, of course, a man from the Isle of Man. You would think it would be absolutely ideal.
Should be perfect for him. Should be perfect for him. It's funny. Back in those days, the continental pros, if they came back for the nationals, often just, you know, showed their class. If the course was hard enough, if the course wasn't hard enough, they tended to be ganged up against. But if the course was selective, that was one of the most selective courses there's been. And Robert Miller, that was pretty much that was his last race. In effect, he did a bit of mountain biking afterwards, but that was the last time we saw him in a road race.
I think that year, I'd have to double check this anecdote, so this is incorrect, I apologise, but I think the Irish riders also rode that national championship, and the first Irish rider, I don't know who it was, but the first Irish rider,
probably David McCann,
would be the champion. But Sean Kelly was riding, I think, or was this earlier than that? No, he wasn't, was he? 95. No, I've got this wrong. It was another, but the anecdote, because Graham O'Bree was riding, so no, it wasn't 95.
Leave
it
this stuff
earlier,
in as well.
Earlier than that. But so that this anecdote doesn't really work. It's not about the Isle of Man, but it's about the national championship.
Yeah.
But basically, Kelly was concerned that O'Bree was basically bouncing off people in the peloton like a
dodgem.
Like a dodgem, yeah. And so he went up to O'Bree and said, "Oh, you're obviously really strong today. Why don't you attack?" And O'Bree just rode off the front and spent a couple of hours up the road on his own, and the peloton had a nice stress-free couple of hours.
Yeah, I mean, I just mentioned there that Robert Miller, that was last we saw him in a road race, but actually, a couple of years later, when he was British national coach, he used to ride the Premier Calendars to watch the riders. He never got involved in the racing, he never went with brakes or anything, he just rode around the bunch just to observe, which was very unnerving. I rode a lot of those races, and it was quite unnerving, because you're on your limit, and here's a retired bloke. The national coach seems to be floating along perfectly easy. Can I just plug my book? Because I realised recently that this is a 10-year anniversary of the publication of my book, In Search of Robert Miller. So it seems to have gone very quickly, that 10 years. Can't quite believe it. But 2007, that came out on the eve of the tour starting in London.
Yeah, it would have been the 94 championships that Kelly rode for the last time, I think.
Oh, is that you just searching your brain, Lionel?
Yeah, searching
brain sponsored
my
by
brain
Google.
Slash the internet. Brian Smith won it that year.
He never mentions that, does he? And the Tour de France, just on the back of the national championships. We're all looking forward to the tour, aren't we? Daniel, are you looking forward to the tour?
Well, yeah, Rich. But on the national championships, just looking at all the routes, got all the route profiles in front of me for all the different countries in the world, predominantly the European ones. For the hipsters, this is always a good day for the real kind of the internet trawling hipsters to... it's a real badge of honor if you've not watched the national championships in your own country, but you've, you know, you found a moody stream to the, I don't know, Lithuanian national championships, which finishes up a 44% climb. Anyway, I would recommend, if you have access to such a, we obviously don't condone that kind of deplorable use of technology. But the Austrian National Championships was very, very difficult. Big old climb in that, very steep climb. The Swiss Nationals also pretty mountainous, pretty hilly. A big surprise, I know, that the Austrian and the Swiss National Championships are hilly this year. And that the Belgian ones are pan flat, completely flat. So whoever's the best sprinter in Belgium at the weekend is going to be the national champion there. France looks hard as well in not a particularly mountainous part of France, right in the north at Saint-Omer, but a very tough circuit. And the Spanish one as well in Soria, I think. Pretty much finishes up a climb. I think Alejandro Valverde is not quite a shoe-in, but is a very good bet to win there. The Italian one finishes in, it's the Gran Piemonte organisers, or the, some kind of, I don't know whether RCS are organising it, but anyway, it's pretty much some kind of approximation of the Gran Piemonte route, and it finishes in Ivrea. Climb at the end, Vincenzo Nibali thinks that it's perfect for his teammate Giovanni Visconti, Bahrain Merida.
What about Slovakia?
Well, Slovakia, I actually did look at Slovakia, and there's a bit of a climb in the finale, but it looks perfect for a Sagan, whether it's Juraj, Peter, or maybe even Lubomir, who we have discussed previously, who weighs about 140 kilos. And is Peter's father.
I don't think so. Yeah, I think Peter Sagan's unborn child has a better chance than Lubomir, the father of Juraj and Peter. Peter Sagan is to become a father.
He is.
Do you see that?
Sagan's going to be warm, isn't he, in all his jerseys? He's got to wear the European Road Race Champions jersey, the World Champions Road Race jersey, the National Champions Road Race jersey, potentially, and his own jersey, and the green jersey.
Here's a question that I don't know the answer to, right? In the women's peloton, Anna van der Breggen wears the European Champions jersey. If Peter Sagan wasn't also the world champion and therefore wearing the rainbow jersey, would he be wearing the European Champions jersey?
I believe so.
That's interesting. That's a new thing.
All of the national champion winners, it's always great when you see the riders turn up at the Tour in their new jerseys. They've got a week, of course, to go out and buy them and stitch their own team logos on them. I think that's how it still works, isn't it?
I think Lionel's had too much sun again.
Moving on.
Bring him in. Bring him out of the garden.
Yeah, okay. That's enough of that, Lionel. I'll dampen your mood. The Tour de France is coming. You looking forward to that?
Yeah, it's long though, isn't it? It's long.
You know, it's a long old
I'd like slot. To do a week of it at home in the middle. I think you got the Giro absolutely right. They do the start and the end.
No, I think you've got to be there the whole thing. Yeah, Tour, it's a 3-week journey. You've got to be there for every step of that journey.
I'm particularly looking forward to revisiting some places I've been before on holiday, particularly the stage in the Dordogne. That's the one I think will look beautiful, goes past some very attractive looking places. That is stage 10, Périgueux to Bergerac, goes past a little town called La Roque-Gageac, one of the most beautiful villages in France, goes up a little climb. I'm hoping it goes over the climb to Dom, which is a lovely hilltop town, a really nice climb up and over. The pros will make mincemeat of that, but it's quite a tough climb if you get a chance to ride around there. A beautiful countryside in the Dordogne, and I think the food will be good there as well.
It's actually one of the better Tours de France for wine as well, Lionel, I would suggest, because there are stages. Let's just have a look. Well, there's the stage finishing Nuit Saint-Georges, a bit of a mecca for Burgundy wine, if you like your Pinot Noir, Lionel. The stage de Troyes, which kind of kisses the Champagne region. The stage that finishes in Po.
The only problem with Troyes, Daniel, Troyes is worrying me because it's the home of Andouillette, the horrible, disgusting sausage, which is, I say this every time.
I thought that'd be right up your street.
No, it's really unpleasant. It's like...
horrible.
It's got the texture of a Veruca sock filled with rubber bands and drain water. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely foul. So I'll be avoiding that.
I can verify that. I've made that mistake before as well. And then, of course, we go to Bergerac on stage 10. The hipsters, Bordeaux is Bergerac. And then the next day, Madiron country. Very tannic, powerful, alcoholic red French wine. In stage 11, that's what you'll be drinking that day, Lionel.
Well, sticking with the culinary theme, we've actually teamed up with Modern Salt culinary website, and they've booked us half a dozen or so very decent little eateries, Richard, spread out over the course of the tour. I think we've got two or three in the first week, one in the middle week, and then one in the at the end, and we'll be reporting back. They're basically table d'hôte, so rather than, you know, sort of stressing about whether we're going to find somewhere to serve us dinner, they will be staying open for us, and we'll be laying on whatever the local specialties are. So looking forward to that.
I have no doubt at all that these stories from these restaurants will form part of the output in the podcast over the next few weeks. We'll be joined at the tour by Francois Thomazeau, a bit of a gourmand. He's written about certainly Paris bistros, and written a lot about food and drink in France, so he'll be all the experts I need on hand. And Daniel, hopefully you'll be able to join us a little bit at the tour as well, as you did last year. It's very similar to last year, the difference being that Francois will be joining us as a permanent member of the team this year, and we will be producing our usual nightly episode, kicking off on the Friday with a short preview episode, then the nightly episode. And Kilometre Zero, plans for Kilometre Zero still being firmed up as we speak, but we will announce them very soon.
You'll notice I don't mind speculating about the food and the drink. That's fine, but I don't like speculating.
I was going to ask, are we going to speculate at all about the race?
Yeah.
Are we?
I shall allow it. A few minutes of speculation.
Okay, a few minutes of speculation. I think it's going to be a very interesting race because...
I disagree.
Well, looking at the course and looking at the way that it's set up, and the lack of, you know, I think there's one summit finish on an or category climb, isn't there? There are three summit finishes in total, and La Planche de Belfi is the first one, and it's a tough climb, and it could establish a pecking order that we don't really want that, because we want the race to remain open. But if the race is open, there are lots of opportunities for ambushes, for things to happen. We saw the Dauphiné, what happened to Richie Port's going to Tours, one of the favorites, but I think there is that question mark about how prepared he would be, how able, how sort of fleet of foot he and his team would be in the event of a Movistar or somebody, you know, launching some kind of ambush. I don't think Alberto Contador is going to win the Tour, but I think as at the Vuelta last year, he will have an impact on the outcome of the race, because, you know, if he's not in form and if he abandons this new conservative approach, which he probably will have to, I can see him lighting up certain stages and really doing quite a lot of damage to the GC.
One bit of speculation, Rich, and that is about, well, the impact on the race and the future of the race of this decision to televise the whole of every stage. I think it could be one nail in the coffin, not necessarily the last nail in the coffin, but of long 200 kilometer plus stages on the Tour de France. I think the contrast between stage 13 to Foix, which is 101 kilometers, and I don't know, a 222 kilometer stage from Embrun to Salon de Provence is going to be so striking and so stark and so unflattering for the longer stage, that I think there's going to be real pressure on Christian Prudhomme and Thierry Gouvenou, the guys who designed the tour route in the future, to adapt to, well, and to further embrace this trend we're seeing of certainly people enjoying shorter stages more. And, you know, we saw further evidence at the Dauphiné of that, the last stage in which Jakob Fuglsang dethroned Richie Port, which everyone hailed as one of the great stages they've seen this season and maybe for several seasons. That was very short, and we see it consistently, and we never really see a dud of 100 kilometers or 120 kilometers. We talked last week about the Hammer Series, how intense that was, over 70, 80 kilometers. So that is going to be one of the big takeaways, I suspect, from this year's Tour de France.
Yeah, I agree with you, Daniel. I think that there must be slight feeling of nervousness at ASO's headquarters. The prospect, that particularly in that first week where there are a lot of flat stages, that it would suit the bunch to just let the usual suspects, the break. I mean, you could have a nightmare scenario of successive days where it's a Cofidis rider, a Direct Energy rider,
a
Wanty Group rider, and a Fortuneo rider. No disrespect to those teams at all, but the kind of the wild cardy teams sending riders up the road, breaks of three or four, which is, you know, hard. It's a hard watch because there's no way you can inject any kind of suspense into, you know, whether or not that a break like that would stay away, particularly when it's 200 plus kilometres. There could be some people sort of saying this has been a terrible mistake to broadcast the whole lot right from the start. But it's the beginning of a you know, a new regime really for the tour, isn't it? The riders won't necessarily adapt and change on day one, but you're absolutely right. That stage from Saint-Girons to Foix, the 13th stage, which happens to be Bastille Day as well, so short. It would be everybody be on holiday, everybody be watching. You know, you're right, there'll be a massive contrast between some of the days. And I would suggest if people are looking at taking days off, they should look at the route and try and work out which are the best days to take off to spend in front of the television.
If you're in France, you'll get that day off anyway.
That's true.
We'll
still celebrate Bastille Day here until 2019, right? Until we've left the EU. Is that how it works?
Enough of that, Lionel. So I read one of the interviews in this month's Pro Cycling. One of the writers just talking about it's psychological, but it's also physical. The difference between a 3-hour stage and a 4-hour stage. A 3-hour stage, riders are going to that fearless. They can ride that. They can ride 3 hours flat out. A 4-hour stage just builds in that little bit of a sort of bit of doubt, and you can't ride for 4 hours flat out. But 3 hours, you can really take it on right from the start. And that's why we see that such aggressive riding over those stages of 100, 110, 120 kilometres.
I'm also looking forward to the very end of the race. This is another kind of innovation, ASO using their heads here. You know, the big quest has been, how do we generate some funds? Well, the final time trial will begin and end in the Stade Vélodrome in Marseille, the football stadium, home of Olympique Marseille, of course, home of François Thomazeau, who is an Olympique Marseille supporter.
He doesn't live in the stadium.
No, he doesn't
though.
Live in the stadium, but he does live in Marseille, and yeah. he is a supporter. And at the last count, they'd sold over 40,000 tickets for this. I believe the stadium holds 67,000 people. I mean, that could be
an
incredible
phenomenal
atmosphere in there. A hot day, the end of the tour. You know, the stadiums like that really generates
remember
a noise.
Remember the stage start in York? You know, when we had the horse racing enclosure, and the stands were filled with people, and it was really quite a spectacle.
Well, there was a buzz, wasn't there? That was the thing. And I think that does sort of transmit itself and make the whole thing feel like it's a real event, a sense of occasion. I'm looking forward to that. And I mean, the dream scenario would be that something's hinging on that time trial, the same way it was in the Giro d'Italia just a couple of weeks ago.
Although remembering York, although it was an incredible backdrop and a great atmosphere with the stands full of people, all I remember about that stage was at the start was Ciro sort of hiding from Luca Paolini, who was angry at him for having run a story about him using his mobile phone. Just sticks in my mind somehow, just seeing Ciro at the York race course, just quite unusual. Joining up with Ciro again, of course, at the tour, he'll be joining us hopefully quite regularly whenever he buzzes past.
Yeah, I mean, he'll be on Aru duty, I guess.
Aru duty, and Aru might do okay. We might see a race where, as I mentioned in relation to the Dauphiné last week, teams that have perhaps two strong riders, three strong riders, Movistar or somebody, could be a real advantage if it is quite an open race and if there isn't a really clear outstanding favourite. And maybe Froome will come into the kind of form we've seen him in the last couple of years. The signs haven't been there so far. Sky are announcing their Tour de France team tomorrow, Thursday, in fact. So some reasonably difficult decisions for them, but
pretty sure Chris Froome will be in it though. They'll be wearing their white away jersey as well, won't they? First time, so they'll be difficult to spot, unfamiliar. Look out for them in white rather than black. All these things
you got to think
of. It will be weird, won't it? Just on that first day,
it'll be weird for about 2 days, and then we'll probably be quite used to it.
That's weird. La Planche des Belles Filles, of course, on the Wednesday. Talking sort of doom and gloom, worst case scenarios, which, you know, that falls to me to do that, doesn't it? If Chris Froome were to win convincingly at La Planche des Belles Filles. Of course, he won in 2012 there, the first time the Tour ever used that mountain. You know, that it could be a long couple of weeks after that, but let's hope not. Let's hope it's really open.
Well, I think that's probably... I don't think we want to do any more speculation, do we, Daniel?
No, I would suggest not.
Okay, well, let's wrap things up there. Go and pack our bags. Get ready for France.
It's a bit early. It doesn't take a week to pack.
Well, you gotta be prepared, Lionel.
We haven't even booked a car yet.
That's
got nothing
true.
To drive.
If anybody wants to offer us a car at this stage, that would be great. No, but that's all simply organised, Lionel. It's all in hand. We've got we're booked on the channel. We've got hotels for pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, I've just got to buy a tent in Decathlon just in case.
Well, yeah, we're having a few cancellation issues, but we'll get there. We're getting there, you know, we're getting there. So we'll see you in Dusseldorf, Daniel.
Yes, see you there. Looking forward to it.
Lionel, see you on the way to Dusseldorf.
Pick you up in Folkestone.
Watford.
Great. See you there. Cheers, chaps.
Thank you.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.